town appraiser, Jay Closser, is being interviewed for Concord's oral history program by Renee Garrelick on March 30th, 2000. Jay is leaving after 17 years. He was hired in January 1983 by Finance Director Tony Legalbo at the very young age of 30. When you were hired, it was it came out of a recent tax assessment and evaluation in 1983.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's my understanding that statewide, towns and cities were required by the courts to undergo revaluations. And along the basis of Proposition 2 and a half, but in essence what they were required to do at the time was to revalue the town at 100% of market value every 2 years, and that had not been the case prior to that. Prior to that, it had been pretty much willy-nilly. Some towns would revalue properties and others wouldn't, and there also was not the direct correlation between 100% market value and the assessments. And so by bringing the assessment process into line with market values, the thought was that assessments would then be more consistent and therefore fairer. And this was all brought about by various and sundry lawsuits, one of them in Boston involving a commercial property, and they found out that commercial properties were being valued higher than market value, whereas residential properties were being valued lower than market value. So the intention then of the revaluation process was to address that and to have everything tied to market value. And so what transpired then was that towns had to come up with a plan to do this. And the way that you did it was you hired a company or a consultant to come in and revalue your property. And Concord first attempted to do this, it's my understanding, in 1981 or thereabouts, and the first effort was handled by an outside company, and like in some other towns as well, but in Concord there seemed to be a lot more outcry than perhaps in some other towns, and it's my understanding that as many as 1,100 people came to the townhouse to complain about their values. And part of the revaluation process that, as specified by state law, requires that there is a public information period, an informal period in which the public can comment on the values. And that's what was happening this particular day when 1,100 people showed up, so a lot of people had comments. And they felt that, in particular, that the values were totally inconsistent, and they felt that the outside company just didn't have an understanding for the town. So what happened was the town decided they had to do something about it. So they brought in the real estate community, and they had to advise the assessors. So the assessors had five members, and then they brought in maybe 12 members in the real estate community to set up a committee to offer suggestions, I guess, as to how to, and one of the things that they did was they broke the town down into 19 different neighborhoods and then a bunch of sub-neighborhoods after that. But throughout the process of dealing with this first revaluation, it became apparent that, you know, that there was a need for something else. And I guess that it was decided that the town needed to get a town appraiser on board that could oversee this process rather than having an outside company do it that, you know, that wasn't familiar with the town, that basically was interested in coming in, getting the job done, and then leaving. And so it was felt that the town would be better served to have somebody like me, I guess. And so I was brought on board in 1983, and from that point on did all the revaluations in-house.
You are the very first in-house tax town appraiser.
Well, it's my understanding that there were a few people in that position before, but The difference, I think, is that when I came in was that the assessment process had become a much more highly regulated process and had a lot more oversight than it had before, which meant that there were a lot of pitfalls that could occur with financing the town. If you didn't meet all these requirements, you couldn't get your tax bills out on time. And I believe that since 1983, we have not sent a single tax bill out late. So that's
wonderful.
Something that I'm proud of.
Now, did Tony Legalvo, the finance director, hire you?
Yes, he did. It was actually a rather extensive interviewing process, and I came out here from the city of Boston answering an ad in the Banker and Tradesman. I'd always liked Concord, and I didn't really think I was looking for a job at the time, but as I started interviewing, I realized that this sounded like something that, you know, that I would be interested in. And so Tony was talked to me initially, and then I talked to Steve Schaefer and Tony, and then I talked to Steve Schaefer, Tony, and the entire Board of Assessors. So it was, I think, at least three interviews, if not more. And
Steve Schaefer being the town manager at the time.
Steve Schaefer was the town manager at the time, yes. And so he would have been my first town manager, and there have been two since then.
Mm-hmm.
But I was the first town appraiser to come into the town and be responsible for the revaluations, and there has not been an outside company in to do them since then. And I think that has benefited the town, and because at the very least the residents have somebody to talk to, you know, somebody who's there on a daily basis.
And that has made a big difference.
People
have appreciated that.
Well, I think that when you deal with government, the greatest frustration is just the inability to get anything done, and oftentimes even get a particular person to talk with. And so, in fact, when I first started here in Concord, I noticed right away that there was indeed a feeling amongst the public that nobody listened to them. And for example, I had a number of people would come in and say, you know, I told the assessors about the fact that I tore down that shed, or that I only have four bedrooms, or that I don't have a pool, or whatever. And it still shows up on my tax bill and on my card. What's the story here? And so I did something very fundamental, but that did not exist, and that is I started a folder on every property. So when somebody came in with a letter and said, hey, I've got a problem here, that letter went into that folder. And so it was there for, you know, so I couldn't say, oh, no, I never got that letter, or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think that's all part of the accountability process that I think was required, and that I believe that we've maintained during this period.
Before we get into the changing property trends, what is your assessment of the role of the Board of Assessors with the town appraiser?
Mm-hmm.
How do you see that?
Well, I always felt that the Board of Assessors was there to take the blame, and I was there to take the glory. You know, if, for example, if there were a negative decision involved, well, we blame that on the board, whereas if there were a positive decision involving an abatement or something, then we would say that we convinced the board that you should deserve an abatement. But basically, I consider, I mean, yeah, that's sort of true, but in reality, the board is there as the calming influence. And when I say that, what I mean is that when you are in a public position and you talk with members of the public and you're dealing with valuations and assessments, you tend to be swayed perhaps or influenced, and that's all well and good, but then when you're convinced and then you have to present it to the Board of Assessors, sometimes they're not convinced. You know, and so they're really there, I guess, as an oversight. And to establish policy, you know, while a lot of discussion might go into it, there are certain policies that need to be followed, and So while the board is indeed ultimately responsible for the value, in fact, their signature is on the values, not my signature. I advise the board, and through the years, I suspect that they came to rely on me more and more. But nevertheless, there was always that further step involved, and once I made a decision, then I would have to run it by the Board of Assessors. So I believe that the board is there to help keep things in line, to establish policy, and to some degree, I suppose, for protection, from the regulations and just the whole process. It allows just an extra level that I think is very important. And indeed, the board represents the various sections or sectors of the town. So that I think is very important too, because the assessing process is indeed a public process. It's not us against them. It's just like this sort of us, doing what we have to do as a community to fund.
So they actually look to have good geographical economic distribution.
We've always taken that into consideration, and it would be the various, as well as considerations, for example, there would be maybe somebody who was from the business community or something like that, affordable housing. But there have been various types of people through the years, and there have been few lawyers and few real estate brokers, which I, because perhaps they're related, but they might also be too busy. But it's really across the broad section, I think, of society here in Concord in general.
And they require training.
Yes, they do, which is, while somewhat onerous, in that it's, I think, to my knowledge, it's the only board or committee in town that if you join it, you have to take a class. But that was all part of the revaluation regulations and laws that I talked about earlier. The state determined that the whole process was so inconsistent that they set up an education process that every assessor is required to take a course that is approved by the Department of Revenue, and it's at least 12 weeks, and it's a long course. You can take it they can go to the assessor school and do it for a week, which isn't everybody's idea of a great vacation in August, or you can do it during the year, one night a week for 12 or so weeks, and by the end of it, though, every single person has said they learned a lot more. Not many of them said it was the most exciting course they ever took, but yes, so they are required to do that, which I think is good, even though it does put a lot of demand on a volunteer person, to have to take this course.
That stemmed from 1981, when assessment was going to be at fair market value. Was there any tie in at all? Because that's the same time period that Proposition 2.5 was coming in, mm-hmm. and you had levy limits.
Right.
Do you feel that there was a connection?
Yes, most people, I think, believe that they are one and the same, Prop 2.5 and the decision to do revaluations. In fact, they are somewhat different. They just happened at the same, roughly around the same time. The Traeger bill, which I mentioned earlier, was the process of the lawsuit that brought about the decision that assessment should be at 100% of market value. But then Proposition 2.5 is a taxpayer's initiative that was started by some of the various well-known tax groups in the state, but it was passed by in a general election and became the law. And in essence, what it says is that the total levy cannot go up by more than 2.5% a year, plus new growth and any unused levy capacity. It does not, however, say, and most people think that it also, that 2.5 applies to you as an individual. In fact, it applies to the whole town. Sure. And that's really part of the problem, I think, and that is that while I think the revaluations are very important and definitely have improved the assessment process, the problem is that you're tied to to explaining market value with assessments, and in fact that can cause rather broad swings across town, because I found that we did the revaluations every 3 years. After 1984, you could do them on a 3-year basis rather than a 2-year. They changed, they realized that was too soon. And so every 3 years, we would revalue the town. I would find that there was some sector of the real estate market that went up more or less than another. You know, 1 year it was all the outlying properties seemed to go up more than those in town. The next revalue, it was maybe all the condos went up more or down more, something like that. And while over the long term they might, these variations might tend to come together and be more consistent, in a short term on a 3-year basis it causes broad swings. And so when you do a revaluation and somebody's value goes up by, say, 20%, somebody else's goes down by 20%, then that person that went up by 20% is going to see a lot more than a 2.5% increase, and it's perfectly legal because we're tied to the market. But nevertheless, the whole town levy cannot go up by more than 2.5%, which, if you think about it, is a very difficult nut to crack, so to speak, because lots of things go up by more than 2.5% a year. You know, I mean, even in good years, inflation has been like almost 2.2% or something like that. So, in a bad year, if it's 4%, well, you're going to have a hard time keeping up with inflation at 2.5%. But it nevertheless has forced people to, in towns, to think about how they spend their money, which I believe is the goal of it.
Do you think it's too restrictive a measure?
Well, I think that it would make more sense for it to be a variable rate you know, rather than a fixed rate, because, in fact, times change, and It would be a wonderful thing if you could have 2.5% and stick with it. But in fact, that's not the case. You know, and now when you would think that there was no problem at all because the market's so good, the economy's so good, that's not the case. Concord is looking at the possibility of an override this summer for operating expenses, and that's simply because we're getting up against 2.5. You know, so even though times are better now and you'd think there'd be more money around, the strictures of 2.5 limit the amount that the town can raise. And so that is a problem. But on the other side of the question, there does seem to be a tendency in government to constantly grow, I suppose. You know, at least that's what they claim on a federal level. I don't know if that's true on the local level, but certainly Proposition 2.5 would constrain that.
The trends that you've seen in 17 years in building residential, commercial?
Well, it indeed has been quite cyclical. When I first came here in 1983, to some extent, the country, New England in particular, was still reeling from the oil price shocks of the 70s, 1973, 1978, and what that had done. I mean, for example, gasoline was 28 cents a gallon my entire life, and then in 1973 it was 55, and 1978, you know, it was a buck, and then it just started varying. And what that meant was that your big house suddenly cost a lot more to heat. And not only that, the country was was actually thinking about saving on gas mileage in cars and thinking conservation and alternative forms of energy. And, you know, while we may not be thinking about that so much now, that was the case back then. And so, as a result, a lot of the large houses, which today we call mansions, you couldn't get rid of them. You couldn't give them away. And that has changed dramatically, you know. And I mean, there are many more changes which I'll mention, but now those very houses are in extreme demand, and it doesn't, they really tend, from what I've seen, they sell based on how big they are, and you know, $300, $400 a square foot of living area for the top end properties. And if they're 10,000 square feet, then they sell for, you know, $3-4 million. If they're 5,000 square feet, you know, so my point is that now size is in, and with those big properties, you can do more with them. Back in 1983, that wasn't the case. And back in 1983, the highest sale that year was a house in Catarina Heights that sold for $396,000, which I thought was shocking, shockingly high. And, you know, there actually had been some higher sales in earlier years of some huge properties. But to give you an example, I think in 1980, it might have been 79 or 78, but around that period, one property owner bought some land on Monument Street out near the Carlisle border. Basically just woodland and a little open land. It was quite a bit of acreage, but they bought it for, I think, $275,000, and now it's, the year 2000, and over the last 3 or 4 years, those lots were developed in the 90s and have been selling in what's known now as Monument Farm, and where a single lot, 2-acre lot, will go for $500,000, and, there's, 18, 17, 30, I'm supposed to know these exact numbers, but there's quite a few lots there that were made out of this, and the whole thing was purchased for $275,000. So, there really have been some remarkable changes, and really at the time, the $275,000 probably seemed pretty high. There's another property out there on Monument Street that involves nearly 180 acres that was purchased in 1980 for about $800,000. Now it's worth $7 or $8 million or something like that. So there have really been some phenomenal changes there. The market increased at a dramatic pace from 83 to 86, and really from 85 to 88, I guess, would have been the most dramatic. And then in 1989, it fell for the first time, and real estate in Concord actually dipped down, and somebody that bought a property in 88 and sold it in 91 probably didn't do very well and definitely lost some money. And in 1991, for the first time ever, we did what we called an interim year value change, and that was because we felt that values had fallen far enough below assessments that theoretically every person in town could go to court and win an abatement. Our thought process was that once you get below 10%, so if if your house is assessed for $500,000 and it's only worth $450 and going down, then from our perspective, we were in trouble. Not that we expected the residents of Concord all to file, and indeed most of them understand the process, but we lowered values that year by about 15%, and then the next year we did a revaluation, and they may have gone down a little bit more. Some sectors, condominiums, were just were killed at that point. No one, you couldn't get rid of them, so they went way, way down. Now, of course, that's changed. They went way, way up in the last 3 years, and that's just sort of the way things are. It really is incredibly cyclical, but it is very much tied to the availability of capital and the economy in general. When employees or salaried employees are getting big bonuses, they have money to spend, and when they have money to spend, they're willing to pay more to be in a certain location, and that's supply and demand, and Concord is a desirable location. When times are good, the price of land in particular goes way up. It can come back down again, and I certainly won't be surprised when we do have a downturn, but it has been pretty good since about 1994. It really started spiking, I think, values, in other words, going up rapidly about 1998, they're right up there right now. And the same kind of thing with commercial properties. For example, during a lot of the recession that occurred in real estate and the lack of liquidity that resulted from it was because banks had loaned too much money to houses, to residential, but in general to commercial properties, large office buildings, skyscrapers and whatnot. And there wasn't anybody to rent them. And there was a building in Concord, in fact, that was purchased in 88 for like $10, $11 million and was sold in 94 for $4 million. And it was sold at about $55 a square foot. And there were a number of sales at that point, 1994 and at about $55 a square foot or 50 bucks a foot, and that was the result of just finally getting all this stuff out of the recession, and rent started to pick up and tenants started to pick up at that point, and then all of a sudden in 1997 they started selling for $100 a square foot. You know, so I mean, if you look through the records of the town, you'll find office building A in 1994, $55 a square foot. 1997, office building B, very similar, at $100 a square foot. So they really just boom up, and it really, once again, depends on expectations for the future. In 94, everybody was glum from the, and they were working their way out of the recession, whereas in 1997, everybody's looking forward, saying, well, if we're getting 20 bucks a foot now, we're going to get 30 bucks a foot next year, and, you know, and that's sort of the way that it works. Reality, of course, always lags somewhat behind expectations, whether it's on the positive side or the negative side. It never gets quite as bad, I don't think, as everybody thinks, and nor is it quite as good. And people have a great capacity to think that their property is worth more than it is, except, of course, when they're talking to the assessors.
Tax classification. You've seen that change from a disparity between commercial and residential to the uniform tax rate. Can you discuss that?
Well, yes. As I talked earlier about the Treasurer bill and Prop 2.5 and revaluations, commercial properties were by and large overvalued for whatever reason, political reasons or perhaps lack of understanding. They don't sell as often as residential properties do. They're not, you know, certainly not like the stock market where you can just look and see what IBM's selling for on any given day. It really varies. But one of the results of the revaluation process, valuing properties at 100% of market value, was that in the first revaluation year, in just about every town, but certainly in Concord, the value of residential properties went up and the value of commercial properties went down. And, you know, as I was saying, between 1994 and 1997, it went from $55. So there's a lot of variation in the market in commercial, but nevertheless, you know, if you're valuing as of a certain point in time, which in assessing is always January 1, and a revaluation year is every 3 years on January 1, then you are looking at the market as of that date. And certainly you have to keep in mind trends as opposed to just data points. You know, that's very important, because if you just stick with data points, you can get some really wild spikes. But if you look for trends, then that's better. But to answer this resulting disparity the disparity was before the revaluation, but then when properties began, the commercial and residential properties got to the same 100% level, and the result was that commercial assessments had come down and residential assessments had gone up. There was, of course, an outcry from the residents, or at least there was a concern that there was going to be an outcry, and the large city mayors, Kevin White among them from Boston, got together and convinced the Department of Revenue through the legislature, I guess, to allow the classification process. And the classification process, many people have researched it to figure out exactly why it was brought about. It's my understanding that it was brought about to deal with that change at that time. In other words, if commercial properties go down, then their taxes are going to go down. Well, what classification allowed was for towns to shift taxes from residential to commercial. And so basically, the way that a tax rate is derived is you come up with the total town levy, and you divide that by the total town value, and that's a simple mathematical calculation, and the result is the tax rate. But and that's called the uniform tax rate. Under classification, the town was permitted, with the selectman's vote, to shift up to as much as 50% onto the commercial class, and which would allow then the residential class to pay less than 100%, you know, as if its assessments were, you know, so if you think assessments and tax levy being the same and they're both at 100% and, the, you know, the breakdown is, say, 80% residential and 20% commercial, then commercial should pay 20% of the tax, residential should pay 80% of the tax. Under classification, you were allowed to shift so that residential might only pay 60%. You know, the drop from 80 down to 60, and commercial, rather than paying 20, would pay 40. And so that resulted in a tax rate that was not uniform, and that was lower for residences and higher for commercial properties. And the town of Concord began that shift, as many other communities did, in 1984. And at that point, the reasoning behind it was that there was no reason that we should not lower commercial property the amount they're paying of the levy, because in essence they're the same properties that were there before, but it's just because of variations in this valuation process. And so the town entered down that pathway based on that reasoning, and it sounded all well and good because it was fairly innocuous. I think the first shift was less than 1%. It was extremely small, and it allowed the levy shares to stay basically the same, even though commercial had dropped a little bit. And that was fine, except that as time went by, residential properties started going up in value a lot faster than commercial properties. And it wasn't because the commercial sector was flagging and losing their value. It was simply because the residential sector was really rocketing.
And, what, you know, time period?
This would be during the mid-1980s. You know, mm-hmm. So from about 1984 through 1989, residential, as I said earlier, residential values were going up at 3% a month, and commercial wasn't. So every year, or every 3 years with the revaluation, we were faced with this dwindling value of commercial. Versus commercial, and in 1984 that was roughly the split in the town. 80% of the value was residential, 20% was commercial. And as the 80s progressed, that number changed to the point where by the end of the 80s it was almost, it was like 90 or 88% residential and 12% commercial. So what that meant was, in order to maintain the same amount of the levy being born or paid for by the commercial and the residential, it was necessary to keep raising the commercial tax rate, or the shift of it. And it got, in my mind, I never really came up with any great justification as to why it made sense to, you know, in the words of the anonymous assessor, stick it to the business class. Although there are those who would argue till they're blue in the face about it that, you know, I mean, from Kevin White's point of view in Boston, he probably figured that commercial property owners don't vote, you know, so let's keep the residents happy. And that, you know, that's one justification. From our perspective, it was really it was a policy option that was available, and we did feel that it was very important to keep consistency and to keep the expectations of the public the same. If you go into a town meeting, for example, and the budget's going up by 5%, and everybody votes and says that's great, and then they have a revaluation, they find out their taxes went up by 15%. That's not good, you know, from the credibility perspective of the town. But that situation could happen in a revaluation year because the commercial sector might have gone down in value so much. So then the question is, well, what do we do about this? And so for a number of years, we kept shifting more on to the commercial class until about 1989 or so. You know, some of these years, you know, it could be a year either way, but about 1989 or so, it reached its peak of a shift of about 22%. And so that went from, you know, 0.9%, I think, in 1984 to 22% in 1989. And while that allowed, and that particular year, the reason that it had to go up 22% was to maintain the expectation that had been generated in town meeting to residents And we realized that it really was becoming counterproductive, particularly because the split in the town had changed from 80-20 to 88-12. At 80-20, if you want to lower the residential rate by a dollar, you have to raise the commercial rate by $5 or $4, you know, however the ratio works there. When you get to 88-12 or roughly 90-10, it becomes much greater number. So it got to the point where no matter how much you raise the commercial properties, it wasn't going to have that much effect on the residential properties. So, and at that point, I abandoned it and said, this doesn't make sense anymore. You know, we just have a dwindling supply. And it just so happened that that at that period, which was late 80s, early 90s, commercial properties were really taking a beating in the recession. And there had been a number of groups organized in the town, or at least one group organized, that was looking at ways of attracting commercial properties to Concord. And I remember talking with Tony Legalbo, and he said, well, why is it that, you know, people were willing to drive to the Rotary in Concord and sit through all that traffic to get to 128 when they could just pull into GenRed and go to work there, or something like that, you know? And I said, that sounds like a great idea. At that time, GenRed was having troubles. They were cutting back on their workforce. They'd shrunken out of their space, so they didn't need it anymore. One of the letters, in fact, that we got when we increased the tax rate by 22% for commercial properties was from the chairman of GenRed, and he said this just makes it very difficult for us to plan. One of the factors that was looked at was, well, what does a split tax rate or a higher commercial rate, what influence does that have on a company's decision whether or not to locate? And it was felt, and indeed a number of property developers from the town weighed in saying that it definitely makes a difference. You know, if I can go to some other town nearby that's just as convenient, and the tax is going to be a buck less a square foot, then that makes a big difference when we're talking about rents at the time that were only maybe $8 a foot. You know, if you're paying a buck and a half of that in taxes, then that makes a difference. Sure. You know, if it goes from 50 cents to $5, say, you know, there's obviously a difference. And some other towns, I think Chelmsford had some success in attracting businesses there, whether it was because of the tax rate, we don't know. But so the selectmen decided to head the other direction at that point in the early 90s, and there wasn't really much resistance from the Board of Assessors either. They were never unanimous except toward the very end, but I think they were always in the majority that they felt that it made sense. From my perspective, I thought the uniform rate was great simply because it's just one less thing that I had to deal with. You know, if you can talk to somebody about their value, but you can't really talk about their taxes because I don't control the tax rate. You know, I control the value. Obviously, they're related, but if everybody has the same tax rate, that just takes one argument off the table, I think. And furthermore, it is fair it's unfair to treat people differently. Now, granted, there are all kinds of differentiations in the tax code. Certainly people that are in the 15% income tax bracket pay less of their total than those who are in the 33% or you know, whatever, wherever it goes to. And that's accepted. You know, people accept that because that's the law. And it kind of makes sense. But when you talk about property taxes, commercial property owners, sure, it's great that they can do business in your town, and they wouldn't be much good if the town wasn't there. If the residents of Concord weren't here, you wouldn't find too many stores in the center. But on the other hand, you know, how many kids do they send to school? You know, and on and on. So you can't. When you get into the taxation process, you really have to buy into the argument that we're all in this together. This is a community, and this is how we fund our community. And to stick it to somebody else for whatever reason is going to cause some kinds of problems, you know. So the uniform rate, in my mind, is certainly easier to support, and I'm glad that we're there. And then even after that, we even did away with. excuse me. There was another
there's the open space discount, which sounds good, and our arguments to the selectmen for years had always been that we believe that the open space discount, which was 15% from the uniform rate, was something that the town was interested in, because while we weren't convinced that it really saved any open space, at least it showed that we thought about it and that we cared about it as a town. But we finally decided that if we're going to have a uniform rate, we might as well have a uniform rate. And so we did away with that as well. And not only that, open space, when you say open space, everybody thinks of conservation land and vacant land and all kinds of things. But the classification itself, from the assessment point of view, is impossible to administer. And it's impossible to explain to somebody why they would get it and their neighbor might not, or, you know. So we really felt that, because it's so vague, I think the law says something like open space is a classification for property that doesn't fit any other classification. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. So there's really, you know, there's no guidance whatsoever. So we decided that we'll just have one uniform rate, and I think we're much better off.
And that's been since about 1996?
Yes, I believe so. Yeah, 4 or 5 years.
Well, I remember your coming as a guest several times when the Concord Business Partnership was discussing this,
mm-hmm.
and I remember when they asked you, what about a uniform tax rate? And you said, that's fine with you.
Yeah, I mean, that's just it. It's, you know, if I could have come up with an argument that made sense to me, I would have used it.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I think it's a great thing, it's just because, you know, surely there's some arguments on it, but there really wasn't. And so we abandoned it, but really it was easy for me to convince everybody that it should be abandoned once I showed them that the ratio between the properties had gone from 80-20 to really about 90-10. And then
mm-hmm.
the math just no longer makes sense. In fact, there was an attorney from town who I had many contentious dealings with in the past, who told me that he had come to that meeting to argue against going to a uniform rate, you know, which basically meant that commercial would pay less and residential would pay more. But that once he heard me talk and present the numbers, he realized that it just really didn't make any sense anymore. So he incredibly enough, bit his tongue and didn't say anything.
Well, you always made it very interesting that there was a rationale and an explanation behind the numbers,
mm-hmm.
and that has meant a lot to people.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that that the hardest part of this job, in fact, has been the thought process that goes into that when you say, well, why did I do what I did? And because the residents of Concord will come in and ask you that, you know, and the worst thing that you know, you obviously can't say, well, I just made it up. You know, you have to think about these things and have a reason for them. And that's what I think distinguishes assessors, or town appraisers, I guess. There aren't many people called town appraiser. I always liked that term, in fact, because I thought it showed that I was an appraiser, that I wasn't one of the assessors, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But basically everybody calls me a tax assessor anyway, so I quit correcting. But that's just one of those things that you have to think about, and that's all part of the accountability process that we were talking about earlier, that you can't just say, well, you know, it doesn't matter, because it does matter. You know, one thing that I learned in Concord in a very early stage, and I think that it's true really anywhere in public business, but seems to be especially so in Concord, that there's no such thing as a non-issue. You know, and as soon as you have the notion that it is a non-issue, you're in big trouble.
Yeah.
You know, so that's why we have really tried to back up what we did with some reasoning behind it.
Overall, in the 17 years, what changes have you seen in Concord?
Well, I guess the obvious changes maybe aren't so obvious to some people, but the houses that are being built are just are getting bigger and bigger every year. There's never been a year when suddenly everybody is building smaller houses. That's just never happened, even in the recession. And one of the reasons for that is that that's what the public wants. But secondly, the land value has become so high that you have to. It's sort of like you have to build a bigger house to justify the land cost or something like that, you know. And you know, there's some extent to which to which town regulations and say subdivision bylaws and whatnot can cause properties land and developments to be more expensive, and perhaps make it so developers have to build these bigger houses. But I didn't see anybody, you know, clamoring, saying, well, if we didn't have to put in granite curbs, and if we didn't have to put in all these trees and drains, and if we didn't have to put the road into this specification, we would build you a bunch of little houses. And, you know, nobody said that.
Yeah.
You know, they said, well, this is awful, but I'm building a 10,000 square foot house anyway. But there was at one point, I remember back in the mid-80s, one big development went into town, and I think there was a deed restriction in the lot sales that said that you couldn't put a house in that was less than 3,500 square feet. At the time, I thought 3,500 square feet was big. Now, 3,500 square feet, that's nothing. You know, I mean, some of these houses today are 10,000 square feet and up. You know, there's at least one house in town that has over 15,000 square feet of space. And these houses don't just happen overnight either, you know, and normally a builder might, a typical builder of the typical American home might have a turnaround or desire or hope for a turnaround time of 3 months. You know, if they can do that, then they might make money. In Concord, you know, 3 months, I mean, some of these houses, it takes 3 years for them to be built, because it's not a development-type town, and it never was, really, although there are a few big developments that have occurred in the 60s and 70s, and like Border, Thoreau Hills, you know, that area would have been a fairly large development, but that's a long time ago, and now the biggest development center is Madison Drive and Monument Farm, and here and there you have these developments, but for the most part it's just single houses being built on large tracts, So there's definitely a change. I remember at one point, I think the past natural resources director, Dan Monahan, said to me that back in the mid-80s when they were building, they'd say the big house, back then the big development was Catarina Heights. And they were building these huge houses, at least so we thought at the time, huge houses. And he said, you know, I just can't believe they're building all these houses, you know, because I'd said earlier about you couldn't get rid of these big things in the beginning of the 80s. Well, you know, the thought was that this was a flash in the pan kind of thing, and that he said he thought one possible scenario would be that when the market goes down that nobody will be able to afford these things, the oil prices will go up, and they'll turn into condominiums, and so we'll end up doubling the size of the town and having more kids in school and whatnot. Well, that didn't exactly happen, but that's a thought. You know, I mean, that's the way the way we look at things. Now we realize, of course, that Catarina Heights was small potatoes compared to some of these new houses that are being built, even though there are obviously some beautiful houses. There are beautiful houses all around Concord. Another thing I think that has happened is, and you know, maybe this isn't true, but it seemed that there used to be this real distinction between the south side of Route 2 and the north side of Route 2, and, you know, whatever that... that it made a difference, and that most of the expensive properties were north of Route 2, and that, to me, it has changed, and I think the one way that Concord real estate seems to be somewhat unique is that when you have a when you buy a house, you know, the old saying was that you want to buy the lousiest house on the best street, you know, and that way you put a paint job on it, it'll go up by 10, you know, paint costs you $2,500 and it goes up by 15,000 or whatever. That is not the case anymore in Concord, it seems to me. I saw a house back in the late 80s. It was a $1 million house built on this road main road right near town, where every other house on the street was a $200,000 house. And you know, so that's the opposite of this, the lousiest house on the best street. This was the best house on the on a worse, you know, on a lesser street. And it sold no problem. And I think, and also I find that in areas of town where the housing stock has gotten older and is smaller and out of style, that that if you come in, if someone comes in and does a major renovation, you know, I've saw situations where someone would buy a house in a neighborhood where everything else was worth, say, $150,000. You know, that was, you could find places like that, you know, 10 years ago. You can't really find that anymore. But, and they would just do a major renovation and then sell it for $375,000, and it would sell. You know, once again, against the logic of why would anybody pay $375,000 for a fixed up version of what of everything else around that's worth $150,000. But in Concord, that works because it's a, it, it seems to me that particularly throughout the 90s, the housing stock has just continually been updated and renovated and improved, and that's basically what has to be done for houses to last. I mean, you know, it's obvious that houses don't last forever. If they did, there'd be a lot more smaller 200-year-old houses around here, or, you know, poorer built. But basically, the good ones and the ones that are maintained are the ones that survive. You know, so there comes a time in every period when the housing stock no longer contributes to the land value, and so that's sort of happening right now. And that had never occurred in Concord before, but over the last 3 or 4 years, we've seen a lot of demolitions where the land is worth so much, and people will tear it down and put up a bigger house. And I mean, in really some rather dramatic cases, in fact. And I haven't really, well, actually one thing on a very basic level is, you know, I've been driving into Concord for a long time, and when I first started working here in 1983, you could drive through the center of town. And, you know, there was the rush hour factor, but then during the day, no problem. Well, now it's just sort of always rush hour, yeah. It seems to me. Yeah. And the number of cars that people own in town, it's a regional thing, the traffic problem in Concord, but in general, though, people have a lot more cars than they used to. You know, I mean, you see, if the average household is, you know, 2.3 people, you know, those 2.3 people seem to have like 3.4 cars or something like that. You know, and that wasn't the case. And I guess that I don't know. You know, I've seen people change an awful lot just simply because I've spent nearly a generation here, you know, and when I first started working here, I had a woman, or a girl, I should say, at the time working in my office who was in eighth grade, and I had her entering data on this little handheld Radio Shack computer that I had programmed a formula into, and it was how I was analyzing commercial properties, and I just said, here's what I want you to do, and I gave her this list, and I found that it would take me, you know, an hour to do one because I had so many thoughts in my head, and I would have to check this, and I'd have to check that, and I realized I was never going to get done. There were like 400 of them to do, so I had her do it, and she's a smart girl, and she just manually did this calculation and printed it. There's this little printer, and printed it out on this little sheet like this. At one point, she said, why am I doing this? But at any rate, she then moved on and then graduated from high school, and then went to college, and then went to law school, and then moved to San Francisco, and I believe is now, you know, a partner in a major law firm out there. And you know, this is just what happens when you're somewhere for 17 years. And she hasn't come back yet and filed an abatement application, but you know. But, you know, it's really sort of the passing of a generation of people, you know, and I feel very fortunate to have been able to spend that amount of time in the town of Concord.
Well, we've certainly enjoyed you. Thank you.
Thank you.